This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the DTV Digest. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me, as usual, are Richard Hawes.
Hello, everyone.
And Stephen Lockridge.
Hello.
This week, we've got five new films to review, kicking off with Frankenstein Legacy, then the Swedish disaster movie The Abyss, Black Mass, Tropic, and VHS 85. Our short shot is The Spirit Hunters, and our DTV throwback is Wedlock. So, without further ado, let's crack on. Our first film, then, is Frankenstein Legacy. For over 100 years, the journal of Victor von Frankenstein has fallen into the hands of many a crazed scientist with a god complex. It now belongs to Clara Browning, who is on the brink of successfully repeating the Baron's experiments in Resurrection. But at what cost? There's been loads of Frankenstein films, of course, and I was expecting something along the lines of a Steve Lawson effort, I have to admit. But honestly, I think this is probably the best script for a Frankenstein movie I've come across in a long time. I thought the story itself was brilliant. I think there are a couple of issues to do with pacing and the kind of generic score that goes with it, but otherwise I thought this had a lot of nuance, a lot of depth. I was thoroughly impressed with it. Steve, what did you make of Frankenstein Legacy?
Yeah, I kind of agree with you, to be fair. It was not what I expected. I mean, when it started, and you know, you've got the, you know, Victor being found, and you know, the guy nicking the book, I was like, well, where's this going? I was expecting, you know, the creature to turn up and then be, you know, flashback, comedia, res, whatever. And then it shows the, you know, the diary being passed around and being stolen and nicked and shot and all that lot in the titles and stuff. And then I think it settles into actually a really, really good story. It takes a little bit to get going after that, I'd say. Just the build up, and then you've got this mad bit where Michelle Ryan just turns up out of nowhere, starts attacking him, attacking the husband of the scientist. And again, I thought that was quite a clever idea, where this you know, switched genders, and it was a woman doing the experiments, you know, rather than just being a damsel in distress or whatever, you know what I mean? It give a nice urgency, but also as well, even the side story with the son working in the asylum, building a kind of relationship with the nurse stroke orderly, and even that as well had a bit more depth, because, you know, he's looking after this alcoholic who turns out to be her father. And it just gives it a nice nuance and a nice place to build on. And yeah, it was thoroughly enjoyable. I was really impressed with this, to be fair. So, you know, I didn't really look into it. I just put it on. And with the start, I'm just thinking, oh, well, it's going to flash back. And, you know, like...
well, like, you know, like a Richard novel, basically. Yeah, I thought that's where it was heading, yeah.
Yeah, all that, you know, Kenneth Branagh's Frankenstein, where he does that. And... It didn't, and it surprised me. And I thought it was actually a really, really good, you know, not a sequel as such, but, you know, moving on from the original story. And like you say, I was kind of expecting Steve Lawson. I mean, I know he sounds awful, but, you know, with all the Dracula ones and the Jack the Ripper and stuff like that, something, all right, they've moved on to Frankenstein now. But obviously, I looked before I started, I did look. So, oh, no, it's Paul Dirich, is it? Dudbridge,
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we've covered one of his films before, I think, haven't we, Rich?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
No, I mean, he's been on the radar, but I don't think I've I don't think we've covered anything of his previously.
No, looking at it, I don't think we have. But no, yeah, I actually really enjoyed this. Like, it was really, really good. Even the, you know, it obviously had a bit more production budget than Steve Lawson type stuff and stuff like that. But no, I really enjoyed it.
Awesome. Rich, what did you make of Frankenstein Legacy?
You mentioned, well, you both briefly mentioned Steve Lawson there, and I think this definitely fits in with the, that, you know, the period horror films that he's set, he's essentially popularized, I think, in the sort of DTV world, because there wasn't a lot of period stuff happening prior to the ones that he started with his Van Helsing movie, and then ultimately the Ripper movies and stuff like that. And there's definitely the sort of the little fingerprints, you know, or the, in the DNA is here, although it's completely separate. But Jonathan Hansler, who was in the and Ripper Untold, is in this one in, as the guy running the asylum. So it was nice to see him again. I thought he looked quite different, but I recognized his voice in his delivery and stuff. So yeah, so you've got the same kind of stuff that Lawson's doing, you know, finding these really good, authentic looking locations and stuff. But as you say, there's a bit more of a budget here, so we get more of them. We've got a lot of different locations, a lot of different sets, I think, as well. Really nice attention to detail, I think, throughout the whole thing. I mean, all the stuff. I mean, the book. You start with the book, like you guys. I thought, well, we're in familiar territory with the start, but I really liked the sort of left field turn of the following the following the book around, and you know,
I really like that.
I mean, it does ultimately go down the same old Frankenstein route, but you know, don't they all? You know, to a degree, so that's absolutely fine. I didn't mind any of that. But yeah, the standard's so good. It's good. It's the production design, I think it's like the basement or the shed or something where she's doing where Millicent. Is doing the experiments. I thought that all looked really good. The cinematography makes everything look excellent as well. Cast was good. Script was good. I thought there was a lot of really good lines of dialogue and moments of the way it was edited and stuff. Like, you know, they weren't like spelling everything out. They were kind of, you know, letting you follow it and then showing you an image of like, so let's say Millicent is, you know, in this situation, and she's, you know, there's something on her mind and they're trying to convey what's going on, but they're not going to say. Sometimes she talks out loud, but sometimes they don't do that, and they show the shovel, and you know exactly what she's thinking, what's she going to do with that shovel, and what's going to be the next scene. You're following it, you're on her wavelength, and I like that. I like Matt Barber. He's now Juliet Aubrey is Millicent. She's essentially the lead.
I've got the names wrong, didn't I?
I don't know.
I said Clara at the beginning. I think that was the daughter.
Okay. But Juliet Aubrey's brilliant as that character. She's really you really believe the emotion and that's driving her, and you know, she's trying to save her husband's life, which is and ultimately even after he passes away, she's trying to save his life. That's what she's driven by. It's completely authentic. The son is pretty unlikable at the start, but he's got kind of a nice arc. But he essentially is the main character. He's the one we spend the most time with. Ultimately, I would have probably liked to spend more time with Millicent, but they kind of narrow her field so much that there's really not much they can sort of dwell on with her. They kind of just sort of let her. Move the story on, you know, be the sort of antagonist of the affair. And Matt Barber's kind of, you know, trying to do in more of the, it becomes that, you know, it's that kind of investigative subplot of, you know, what's happening, you know, finding out and, you know, a couple involved in that kind of situation. So all the period stuff, let's say the production design, the costumes and the locations that they found is really good. I thought the makeup effects were really, really good for the monster. Mm-hmm. Very, very, very good work there. What was the other thing? Yeah, so it's made to, so it is low budget, but it's made to a very high standard. And we do get, as you said, Steve mentioned Michelle Ryan, which is a bit of kind of left field sort of random casting.
Hmm.
But, you know, because, you know, you see the name but automatically that tells you, oh, this is a film that's got a bit more of a budget, but it's still within the low budget. But I'm still really surprised that Michelle Ryan is at this level. You know, there was a time where she was really sort of on the rise. And we talked about this when we did Andron, which was a film she made featuring Alec Baldwin a few years ago.
That's right.
And it's like, you know, she was the Bionic Woman and stuff, but then the series got cancelled and, you know, it kind of was on the downslide after that, unfortunately. But, you know, always nice to see her. Interesting character for her to be playing this, you know. It's like a lot of the stuff with this. It's like they introduce the character in one way and then, you know, they shift it and stuff. She's not everything is as it seems, which is great. You know, the film's an hour and 40 minutes, which is quite ambitious. And they really sort of make the most of that. You know, I didn't feel it dragged much at all. I was very engaged with all the characters and Philip Martin Brown as Robert Browning, the husband who ultimately becomes the monster, but was good. You know, I really liked him.
There's a touch of Julian Sands to him, I thought.
Yeah, and there was another actor who came to mind, but I couldn't remember his name. But yeah, he wasn't who I was saying. Oh, is it that guy? And I kind of looked at him up, and I was like, no, he's not. But they were all really good. I mean, most of the cast to me are unknown. Matt Barber's done like a whole bunch of stuff, including several episodes of Downton Abbey. Which I can totally get, you know, he completely fits into that. I mean, that's what this is. It's a period kind of thing. He very much suits that role and stuff. And nothing but praise really from me for this one. Yeah, really, really pleasant surprise. But I do come back and say, I do think, you know, Steve Lawson is the one we have to thank for all this. Paul Dudbridge, his previous film has been on my radar for quite a while, but I haven't had a chance to watch it yet, which is Fear the Invisible Man.
Oh, yeah.
So he's kind of following a similar track of like, okay, I've done an Invisible Man movie. Now I'm going to do a Frankenstein movie. Is he going to do like another like Universal Monsters kind of character next? Like whether it's the Wolfman or something, that could be quite interesting. I don't know, but I'm keen as ever to see Fear the Invisible Man, and I'm really looking forward to see what he does next.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of interesting aspects to this one. I mean, it's the sort of gender roles for one. You know, we sort of mentioned the fact that it's you know a female scientist. They make a point of saying or reminding us basically that you know the reason she's down in the cellar doing this kind of is because you know society won't allow her to actually become a doctor herself. You know, that's sort of thing. But it's also
and they nice acknowledge how great she could have been. You
exactly,
know,
with proper training and all the rest of it. Yeah, it wouldn't be relying on some duff old book. Lots of other interesting things. So the bit with Michelle Ryan's character, you know, when she's after the book, she turns up and everyone's like puzzled on this. They try to tell her that maybe his wife might be able to help. She's going, don't be stupid, you know, so I'm not here to drink tea with your wife sort of thing.
So
you know, those sort of gender roles and not liabilities. Oh, what's the word I'm looking for?
Archetypes?
No, well...
Stereotypes?
Stereotypes. So, those sort of stereotypes aren't just, you know, from men. You know, they've been sort of hammered into the women as well, basically, on a subconscious level. So naturally, you know, they could not assume or imagine, you know, there'd be a female scientist playing God, you know, down in the cellar. We mentioned the dialogue. Dialogue is great all the way through. There is a particular exchange between mother and son towards the end of the film where she's sort of professing her love for her husband and basically, you know, William is throwing it back in her face going, no, you're basically a completely selfish bitch, you know. All that love you profess to have it was you internalize that you never actually expressed it to anyone. You know, it's a really good sort of argument. I really, really did enjoy that. Yeah, this is great. A real, real surprise. Absolutely loved it. How are we going to score it? Over to Steve.
I'll give it an 8.
8 from me as well. And Rich?
I'll give it an 8. And I just want to mention Alexandra Afreya as the love interest, essentially. So a bit of left field casting and stuff, and I think it really works. She's really good in it, and they've got good chemistry as well.
Yeah, yeah. And she gets some good dialogue in this as well. Like when he sort of turns around and goes, "Oh, it's quite surprising to see so how learned you are and all this sort of stuff." And she's like, "Bitch, I've had to work my ass off, you know." All this sort of stuff is. Yeah, it said it shouldn't be. She's sort of saying it shouldn't be a surprise that I'm educated. You know, that should be the norm. Is kind of what she was saying, and great, great conversation. Loved it. Okay, so there we have it. 3-8 for Frankenstein Legacy. Highly recommended by us guys. Go check it out. Our next film is The Abyss. In the Swedish mining town of Kiruna, Trigger, the head of security at the mine, must deal with both a natural disaster when sinkholes and cracks start to appear throughout the town, and try to keep her family safe. So this is recently turned up on Netflix, Swedish disaster movie, very much in the style of The Wave and The Quake from Norway a few years back. I thoroughly enjoyed this. It was a nice surprise. Critics on IMDb haven't been quite so kind, but I did enjoy this. I thought it was perfect sort of Netflix fare, basically. Steve, what did you make of The Abyss?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It was a bit, you could tell the budget wasn't massive. It's not, you know, like your big Hollywood blockbuster.
I think that's why I mentioned those two other films, because neither of those were, you know, big budget affairs. They had like one big set piece each, you know, but most of it was the build up and everything. You know, there is a sort of more realistic sort of streak to these particular sort of films. But anyway, sorry.
I mean, also kind of reminded me of the, was it called The Tunnel?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
That kind of thing as well. And it, you know, it took a little while to get going, but I did like the fact that, you know, you've got the new, you know, the family parents split up, and, you know, the new guy coming into town early than expected. And I think that'd give it a good balance. I mean, I kept thinking that the kids at the beginning was.
Yes, I know. I thought that was one of it.
You know, because they were looking for him and stuff, and it turned out differently. But I thought it was actually done really well. I mean, especially the mind bit, as it. I know it sounds daft, but it kind of reminded me of the Descent.
Yeah, definitely.
Which
he got the claustrophobia, didn't it? You know, the real,
Yeah, because like when I watched The Descent, I had to pause it before the monsters even come out. Go for a fight to calm down, because it was freaking me out. Because I'm a big lad.
Well, I was saying this to G as well, my wife. You know, it's like, there's no way I'm going to fit through that gap.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's me. I'm fucked. I'm gone. You know, and I'm not claustrophobic, but things like that, I don't like. I'm a bit like, whoa, hang on a minute here. But then you get, the thing that shocked me is you get to the big set piece, you know, and that happens. And I paused it, and I'm like, hang on, there's still half an hour to go here. And I was like, well, where's it going to go? I can't see where, what's going to happen. And, but, he does it well with what comes and what they have to do. It does it. Well, and it's well written, and it's really well filmed. The big set piece is a little bit, tiny bit ropey. if they just had a bit more with the bit more work on the cloud, shall I say? I think it would have just improved it slightly. But I thought the characters are really good. You know, you've got the new fella coming in, the daughter, and the ex husband being a bit of a swat, to be fair, at points, but.
Yeah, even right till the end, he was still, you know, at the end, he was thinking, I've won. You know, even by reference, it's like, I've won, kind of thing. Because it was a pissing contest all the way through for him, and wasn't it?
Yeah. But that's the thing, I mean, the new guy, he's lovely.
Yeah.
He's like, look, mate, I might be stepping your toes, whatever, but I'm not. And, you know, he helps the daughter out and he helps everyone out. And he's such a really nice guy. Mm. And you think, you are a bit of a dick, to be fair. But, I did enjoy this.
Mm. Rich, what did you make of The Abyss?
Yeah, good formulaic disaster movie stuff. Nothing we haven't, as you say, the closest relatives are those Norwegian films. In fact, the characters sort of, and the whole setup of this is very much the same in that it's the family, it's the sort of the very committed sort of scientist who's very detached from the family and causing them fracture and stuff. And that's the one we focus on. Difference here is there's a gender reversal, a bit like with Frankenstein film, is that the lead scientist character is the wife, not the husband, and she's the one that's, you know, very detached and into her work, and, you know, can be quite cold and stuff. So it reminded the film itself reminded me a lot of Dante's Peak, obviously very different sort of budget, but similar in the sort of landscape that we're in. Difference here is that this is an underground disaster. Not like, say, a volcano or anything, but still really interesting. Not one. I'm sure it's been done in other films, but it felt a bit more original. A little bit of a different kind of disaster for us than just the same old stuff. It's actually got a true life basis. In the opening sequences of the film, they established that situations have occurred like this, and this is this is an exaggeration of something that could possibly happen in a blockbuster style.
So you're right. So Kiruna itself is a real place in the Lapland part of Sweden, and the mine itself as well. It's the largest iron ore mine in the world. It produces billions of tons of iron, apparently, but it's got to the point, as the film shows, that the mine is encroaching underneath the town itself. So they are actually moving the whole town, you know, a couple of miles down the road. So
it's on New Kiruna.
Yeah, so New Kiruna, exactly. So, but instead of like doing it all at once, it's taking like about 30 years to do, or 20 to 30 years. But again, they did have an earthquake at one end of the mine in 2020. So, it wasn't sort of a natural thing either. You know, it was caused by the mine or mining. So,
I wonder how the real people, the locals, feel about this. So it really scare them.
Well, hopefully it does, because there is that scene in the film where they set off the town alarms. You know, the whole air raid, the sirens start going off, and everyone's sort of staring at going, what is this a test? Is this a test? What should we do? And they're having to run up to them going, run! Get out of here quick. But, you know, so hopefully people will take a notice. So if they do hear it, it's like, right, it's over, get out of here. I think, funny enough, the most distressing part of the film is when that little kid's playing on his digger in the sandpit.
That's a good scene.
That was really good. there's an interesting review on IMDb most of the reviews on there are quite negative, but one sort of going, oh, this thing is also woke, right? Because, like, you know, you got all these sort of strong female characters and all the men are weak, and then you got the daughter who's like a lesbian, and you know, the new boyfriend is from the Middle East. And I'm reading this, I'm thinking, none of that really registered with me at all when I was watching it. You know,
oh, well, I mean, it did with me, but I didn't think of it as that.
As detrimental or anything, you know.
I think it's very inclusive, but I do think some of it was perhaps in there for no real reason whatsoever. Like all the stuff with the daughter and her girlfriend, it didn't really serve any purpose. It was kind of just there. Whereas all the other stuff, everything else, I didn't have a problem with, but it was just like, I don't, you know, it's fine, but if they didn't do anything with their relationship to sort of make, I mean, even at one point, the girlfriend character basically completely disappeared, and I was like, what's happened with that then? Where's she gone? It's just like, it felt like they'd completely abandoned that whole relationship. Well, I mean, I know she was after, you know, going, you know, they had other things to do, but it seemed like that was gonna, you know, then I know it's a disaster movie, and you know these things are paper thin. I shouldn't maybe be expecting too much, but that was the one sort of part of the film that I thought was a bit weak. I thought everything else, the characterization was really strong.
It didn't bother me, but I mean, if they had changed it to sort of, you know, if it was a boyfriend instead of a girlfriend, they'd have had to rewrite the whole character and the whole motivation of their argument and everything. Because it just wouldn't work. You wouldn't have a guy going, yeah, but my mum needs me. You know, it's like, really? Okay. It's a stretch.
Yeah, look after grandma or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, but anyway. Yeah, other than that, I thought this was very good. How are we going to score it? Steve?
7.
Mm-hmm. And Rich?
Yeah, definitely a 7.
A strong 7 indeed. Yep. You know, it doesn't do anything new. I mean, it is a new setting, basically. But it's pretty well written, the decent set of characters. There's some good sort of interplay between the characters because you have, you know, the ex-husband and the new boyfriend at each other's throats, you know, rubbing each other the wrong way throughout the whole film. Even when he saves the daughter's life, he's still being a dick to him, you know, with his sort of, you know, steals his ring and shit like that. Anyway, yeah, no, this is good fun. It's on Netflix. 3 7s from us. Go check it out. Our next film is Black Mass. This film deals with a 24-hour period when serial killer Ted Bundy stalked and killed a group of sorority girls. Interesting style film this one, Steve. It has sort of a bit of a sort of avant-garde approach to it, you know. I mean, it keeps Ted Bundy off screen as much as it can, or at least his face, you know. We hear his voice, but you know, his back's to the camera when he's in shot. It focuses more on the girls in question, you know, how he sort of like interacts with them at first, you know, then they sort of kick him out of the party, and he goes back later that night and sneaks into their dorm rooms. Quite distressing, that whole sequence towards the end. You know, very well done, very brutal. You know, it makes absolute no qualms about what a, you know, evil, sadistic bastard he was, basically. So yeah, it's different. How did he get on with it?
It is different, but I can't say I liked it, to be fair. It was, I don't know. It's trying to put you in the mindset of Brady, I presume. You know, that's what we're going
for. Yeah, because we got those dream sequences as well to deal with, haven't we? Sort of,
yeah. Quite bizarre. Yeah, and that pulled me right out of it, to be fair. When that happened, you know, the girl in the shower, like, tearing her back apart. I was just like, where's this come from? But obviously, you know, it just came out of nowhere, and I just didn't like the style of it, I'll be honest. It kind of reminded me of something like Grand Theft Auto, or something. You know where you like you got your character and you're behind the character all the time, and
yeah,
it just didn't gel to me with me. I admit the violence when it happened was shocking and totally brutal. It was honest, I think is the best way to put it. Wasn't glamorized, just totally, done how it probably was done. I'll be honest, I've seen a couple of Ted Bundy films, but I wasn't aware that this was an actual true event, shall we say, until I looked it up afterwards. I thought, did he actually do this? Had a look. Yeah, it is true. And at the end, at the end, you've got like post notes on the screen.
Yeah.
That don't really attach to this.
No.
Incident, where he's like, he killed and raped a 12-year-old girl.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for sharing.
Yeah. I'm just watching him fucking brutally rape, kill, fucking beat the shit out of people. And you just bring in that. I don't see why that was relevant. We all know what happened. Well, we don't all know. Know what happened to him. And you can Google what happened to him. And if you want to, you can Google what he did. But to me, this... I don't know. There's just something off about it that didn't settle with me at all.
Okay. What was the other serial killer that Netflix did a series of last year?
Jeffrey Dahmer.
Oh, I said Dahmer, yeah. I get the two mixed up sometimes. Yeah.
I only watched the beginning of this, but I did wonder if it was based on... like you, I kind of get the two guys confused. I was like, is it Bundy? Is it Dahmer? I was trying to think. It's the one that Zac Efron played. I like the opening credits, but I was a bit put off by I thought the opening, because I only managed 15 minutes, I thought the opening was a bit tedious, and I had to really turn up the volume to kind of hear what was going on, what the background noise, dialogue was, stuff was. And then when the sort of first scenes kick in, he goes to this store, and I just felt it didn't fit a bit, like we were talking earlier about like the Frankenstein movie feeling quite authentic to the period and stuff. And this just didn't feel authentic. And he's even buys a bottle of drink at the counter, and the drinks bottle looks like something you'd buy now. Like the design on the label and stuff, just it just sort of struck me that it was like, this doesn't look like it's from the 70s. I was being pulled out of the film, and I was just thinking, I know it's low budget, but it's not. If you're going to do something low budget and make it period, you've kind of really got to be on your game to make it work. And I just was getting a bad feeling that this one it was just sort of coming off as more comical than anything. And then he did the first scene where he goes to and this is where I saw I thought I was like, say Bundy or whatever, because of the car that he was driving, because it was like the Volkswagen. So I didn't know if it was official or unofficial. On the IMDb, there's no credit for the actor as Ted Bundy, so I don't know what the story is with that, whether he's playing a character, whether the character is based on Bundy but isn't actually Bundy, or whether they've just
no they make a point of saying at the end of the film, that the guy they're looking for is Ted Bundy.
So it is Bundy.
So
is the actor who plays Bundy, do you know if the actor who plays Bundy is credited but under a different name or something? No. I was interested in some of the casting though. Kathleen Kinmont's in this. I was really looking forward to seeing her because I hadn't seen her in anything for ages. And she used to do loads of action movies with PM Entertainment and stuff with Lorenzo Lamas. She plays a character called Brenda. Jeremy London is the guy working at the store at the beginning. So I barely recognised him for a second. And Nikki Whelan's in the cast, but she only provides her voice. But everyone else I'm not familiar with. But it's only 80 minutes. So I was thinking, this is the one I think I've got a chance I best squeeze in. But I got that 15 minutes in, I had to break it off, and I was just thinking, I can either return to this or I can try something else. And I was thinking, well, there was other stuff I wanted. I thought, well, I'll give those a go. And, you know, mate, I'll come back to this one if I get a chance. And unfortunately, I didn't. But what you guys have said has not really convinced me much that I've missed a great deal.
I don't think, I mean, I kind of liked it overall, especially the whole assault sequence. I thought it was very well done. I don't want to say I like the assault.
Yeah, you like it. That's what I was going to say.
But yeah. I thought it was very well shot, very well handled, very well acted. That whole sequence, and the end as well. There's that sort of stinger, which kind of made the point of how he was able to get away with it for so long. You know, I mean, they reckon he was, you know, his kill count is supposedly in the hundreds. You know, they only sort of managed to pin 30 on him. I mean, 30 is a ridiculous number anyway, but they suspect he was involved in a hell of a lot more. And he was this guy who sort of just travelled the country, you know. This was another reason they didn't catch him for so long.
On this, at this point, was this where he'd escaped?
Yeah.
Yeah, where he escaped out of the courthouse by jumping out the window.
I think so.
Yeah, I thought it was.
But, you know, it's a very intense film when it wants to be. Yeah, pretty nasty. And I love that. I did like that last scene when they're giving the press conference. I thought that worked really well. So, yeah, this is directed by Devani Pin, who's been around a bit. You know, she's an actress, done a lot of horror stuff over the years, turned her hand to directing. I thought this was a pretty solid effort overall. Okay, scores. Obviously, Rich, you didn't finish this one, but Steve, what are you going to score Black Mass?
I'll give it a 6.
Funny enough, so am I. So, 2 6s for Black Mass. Go check it out. Our next film is Tropic. Twins Lazaro and Tristan are part of an astronaut selection program competing for a spot on a coveted exploration mission. One night, a meteor shower exposes Tristan to an alien bacteria, which starts to infect him alarmingly. Rich, we've come across films before. I'm going to name at least one, which is My Heart Won't Stop Beating Till You Tell It To. And there was another one, it was a British one we did in a similar vein, which are both vampire movies where they strip out all of the fun supernatural elements of a vampire movie. You know, it's like say, yeah, the vampires, but this is what they'd be like in real life, you know, if you're a vampire. And this is kind of what we get here. We get the Quatermass experiment.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, yeah.
But without the fun element, you know, without the pulp. This is like, it's an alien bacteria, but this is what would really happen, you know. You know, this guy is going to get this sort of like horrible disease. It's going to be deformed, you know. Everyone's going to hate him. He's going to be shunned by society, all this sort of stuff, and he's going to gradually just die. You know, it's so bloody, ugh, you know, all the way through. And it didn't really need it, would you say? I mean, this could have just been a film about two brothers vying for a coveted spot on a space program, and that, yeah, I think it would have got a lot of mileage of it that way without needing to go down this route. I don't know. How did he get on with Tropic?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think that all the genre stuff it's like window dressing, you know, it's just kind of. They've added these elements in, but they're really not focused on at all. They're very background, very sort of contextual, but say not even, they don't impact the story really in any way that you couldn't do, you know, without it. You could do the same story with completely contemporary circumstances, I think. But the whole, because I was a bit, I didn't know anything going in. So therefore the start of it, you know, it takes a while to sort of establish the world we're in, you know, that we're, you know, we're 5 minutes into the future or whatever it is, and you know, the things are in a certain, you know, in a certain way, and you know, they're looking to bit. I don't want to spoil anything, but basically, you know, let's say Interstellar is quite a close relative of, you say, you know, we've got to look to the stars, and they're trying to get, you know, they're trying to get the astronauts into space to do that. The only thing is with Interstellar, they actually do get into space, and all, you know, all that sort of stuff happens, and lots of really interesting stuff. Whereas this is completely earthbound. It's not a sci-fi movie really in any standard sense. It's a drama about two brothers, and you know what happens when one of them, who is the more dominant of the two, happens when he is disabled, he's made disabled, and you know, how the other brother deals with it, and that's what this nearly 2 hour movie is. It's that build up, it's that twist around the half an hour point, as we've come to expect, and then, you know, we spend the rest of the time with, you know, the dealing with the situation, how the brother deals with it, and you know what's going to happen, and they kind of return every now and again to this idea of, oh, they're in this space program, you know, they're training to be these astronauts, you know, who's going to be, you know, who's going to get in, you know, pass the test and all that stuff. Because it was always the more dominant brother was kind of pushing his...
Pushing.
And the opening scene of the film is quite... It's a French movie, so it's a bit French. So the opening scene is holding your breath underwater.
Yeah.
And one of the brothers... you know, he has to go. So he's, you know, he's reached his limit, and the other brother holds on to his leg so that he'll stop, because he's trying to, you know, keep him, not because he's trying to, you know, torment him or anything, but he's trying to get
trying
him
to help him.
Of,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, he wants him to succeed and stuff. But he's, you know, he's got the edge, but it takes a while for that to make sense, and because what happened was that they cut to okay, it's a competition and stuff, and I was like, oh, what's going on? Is it like a sports competition or whatever? And they're watching it on a monitor, and I was thinking, well, surely he'd be disqualified. He's just held on to the other guy's leg. Mm-hmm. You know, they would have seen that. But I think maybe because it's in the space program, whatever, they don't really care. But I will say the performances are good. The makeup effects are good. I was interested in what was going on. I did want a bit more sci-fi, I think, from it. But the, you know, I thought all the relationship dynamics were interesting. I felt, you know, they do the stuff with the sci-fi elements, like the stuff falling out of the sky, and they say, "Oh, we don't know what this stuff is," or whatever. And I thought they were going to come back to it, and they don't. No. they never come back to it. It's but, like, you it's know, like Quatermass is a perfect example. Yeah.
They just shrug their shoulders at it. But basically, you know, yeah, I don't know what it is, and that's all you hear about it. You know, no one's doing any further tests on it or anything. So, God. But I mean, the other film that comes to mind is Sputnik.
Yeah, is
another one where, you know, this similar thing, you know, alien organism takes over an astronaut.
I remember that one. Yes.
But at least that
was the Russian one. Yes,
that was the Russian one. That was a proper sci-fi effort. You know, this is
This
is a drama sort of with a bit of sci-fi dressing on the side.
Yeah, I think. I mean, the original. I'm not sure what the. I can't recall what the UK artwork is, but the original poster on IMDb. Doesn't give you sci-fi vibes, so that's fair enough. I think if it's not selling itself as a proper sci-fi movie, well, what I call a proper, you know, like
a genre movie.
It's like, yeah, not selling itself as like a trying to mislead you into, you know, it's a creature film, or, you know, like if they were showing the you know, the creature effects on the poster and stuff, and you know, drawing it. Even the title, I was like, I don't really understand.
I thought, are they on the equator or something, you know, because you don't really sort of get a sense of place out of it, even though everyone, because the two brothers are Spanish, aren't they? They're in a French program, but they are Spanish, and is, you know, it seems to be summertime and everything, so it's that, but you don't really sort of get a sense of place out of it, so I don't know where the name comes from.
Exactly. We get the chapter, because the film's got five chapters, and they basically the breaks are a shot of like a rain of like the tropical forest or whatever, and but the rest of it is not like that. It's kind of, you know, dusty landscapes, you know, normal sort of cityscapes, really. And then there was sort of like the brother who gets hurt by the alien stuff, you know, it affects his mental, you know, it affects his brain and stuff. So he's deformed, but he's also, you know, he's just not you know, he can't do the tests and stuff that he was doing before. So he was like the leading light in the program, and he's not as good. So all of a sudden he's marginalized and he's hanging out with the outcast group. And I just think they kind of did a bit with those characters, but they didn't do much. I mean, they're mostly quiet. There's one of them who's quite, you know, boisterous, and they kind of focus on him. But like, for example, there's the girl in the group who doesn't say anything. I don't know if she's supposed to be mute or they just didn't give her any lines, but it seemed like they could have built on her as a character and taught her to, you know, interacting with some of the other, but they didn't. The other guy there's a guy in a wheelchair and he is mute, so he can't talk. So there's not much, they can't really do much with him, but I would have liked to have seen that group's dynamics explored a bit more, but they kind of just say, oh, they're those characters over there. And so because he's like that, he's going to be over with them now. And the brother is sort of trying to hang out with them, and it's a bit awkward and stuff. But so I felt they could have done a bit more with that rather than just having him sit around with these characters who don't interact much or anything. Which, say, I can understand a group of characters who are comfortable enough in their own company and they just kind of sit around. That's fair enough. But I just felt there were opportunities for a bit more interaction that were. I would have preferred to see developed in more. It just seemed like underdeveloped. But I did like. I thought also he's a bit unsympathetic. The lead character, you know, he's a bit of a knob quite a lot of the time. So even that, you know, you kind of get a bit
got a bit of a chip on his shoulder, right?
Yeah, it's a weird one. I didn't mind it. I was engaged with it. I was going into it and I was a bit worried because I was like, oh God, it's nearly 2 hours. Do I want to go back to Black Mass? Because that's going to be much more easily digestible. But I thought this might be the more rewarding film experience. And I think there was enough that I liked about it, but it's not a film I'd particularly encourage people to go and see unless they're into, you know, dramas and stuff about... you know, brothers and things like that. I mean, I'm a twin. I've got a twin brother. I didn't relate to this film in any way, even that. So I didn't even pick up they were twins. I just thought they were brothers who were a similar age.
I only know that because of the synopsis on IMDb. That's all.
Right. So
how are you going to score?
I thought the mother was really good. I'm going to give it. It's not. I'm just going to knock it down for a little bit, so I'm going to, you know, because of a couple of the criticisms I got, I'm going to say 6.
I'm going a 5 on this one. A 5 and a 6 for Tropic. Go check it out. Our next film is VHS 1985. In this anthology, the wraparound story is Total Copy. Which is a sort of unexplained mysteries kind of documentary featuring a university who are doing some weird experiments on a creature which changes shape. Then we have No Wake, which a group of college students go to the lake and something happens there. It has a sequel later on called Ambrosia, which I really enjoyed. God of Death is a Mexico set film, which involves an earthquake. Then we have Techno God, in which a woman tries to evoke a demon through the internet or something. Dream Kill features a series of videotapes featuring murders which haven't happened yet. And yeah, that's basically the run through. I remember like when we did the last one of these, we didn't actually sort of talk about what the films were about initially. So there you go. I really like this one. over the previous one. I thought this was a lot more consistent. Apart from Techno God, which had an interesting ending, but it was pretty much of a slog to get through. But the rest of them, I thought, were pretty damn good. Steve, what do you make of VHS 85?
I don't know. It's one of them where you've got decent bits and rubbish bits, I'll be honest. You know, mm-hmm. I've never found an anthology that I've been really, really impressed with.
It does not exist.
It doesn't. The total copy, I thought it dragged a bit until the ending.
It did, you're absolutely right. It wasn't really clear what was happening in the room until the very end. But anyway. Yeah.
Dreamkill, I thought, was the best of the lot. I love that one.
Mm-hmm.
Scott Derrickson, so he's got a bit of pedigree behind him.
Yep.
You know, doing like Sinister and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. The Techno God one, absolute bollocks. Absolutely. I mean, I'm one of them. The only thing that got me about that one is when he kept going on calling them iPods.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of like the
iPods. Oh, that was funny, yeah. Because that's the thing, it's set in 1985, isn't it? And this guy has basically come up with, you know, the VR headset and, you know, all this sort of stuff. Yeah, that element of it is all right.
It looks like Tron in a way.
Yeah, exactly.
The thing that gets me is that I can't be arsed, and it bores me to shit, like performance art and stuff like that.
Mm.
And that's what it is. I'm like, get rid of this. Absolute gash. Does my head in. I can't be bothered with it. I mean, I remember when I was at school and I was doing drama and they took us to watch a performance dance piece.
Mm-hmm.
So bored. It just doesn't do anything for me whatsoever. And this just reminded me of that. It's just like angry, mad women screaming on the stage and it's just like, does nothing.
Now, the thing is... That particular sequence, the Techno God one, was directed by Natasha Kamani, who did a really good a film I really liked a couple of years ago called Lucky.
Mm.
With what's the name now?
Just is that Angela Bettis?
Yes, no, not Angela Bettis, but someone I'll think similar.
Of Lucky McKee film.
Yeah.
Bria Grant.
No, it was Bria Grant. That's right. You're absolutely right. Yeah. Really, really good film. Really enjoyed that one. This one, unfortunately, not so much. But I did like some of the ideas at the beginning, and I did like this, you know, the payoff at the end. But the bit in the middle, not so much. Sorry, I interrupted you again.
No, it's fine. And then the No Wake and the Ambrosia one.
Hmm.
That I was quite interested in. I mean. You know, it starts off and then down the lake and stuff, and then the incident happens, shall we say.
Yeah.
And then it carries on.
Yeah.
And you get the twist, and I'm like, oh, that's a bit weird.
Hmm.
And then you get the Ambrosia one, which...
That was brilliant.
At first, I really didn't get the connection at first. I'm like, yeah. But then it goes back and shows you what happened. And I just thought that they worked together really, really well. Mm. I thought they were good. The Mexican one, the God of Death, I didn't really like that one. I thought that was a bit tedious and a bit boring, to be fair. It was just people running through a building, which really did, until the last couple of minutes.
The thing about that particular one is that is the one that sort of stuck to the found footage format in the idea that you have one camera, it's not edited, you know, you're following these people all the way through to the end, you know, that trying to sort of develop that sort of roller coaster ride kind of thing, whereas all the others are very much sort of edited together, you know, so different angles, different shots, that sort of thing. Not so much No Wakes and Ambrosia. That was pretty solid, but it was certainly more with God of Death.
Yeah. So all in all, not bad. Probably better. I don't know, actually. Thinking about it, I probably did prefer it to the last one. But again, it's an anthology. It's, you know, good, bad.
It's always going to be something. You know, they try to cater to all tastes and everything, don't they?
Yeah.
The other thing about the No Wake Ambrosia ones, directed by Mike P. Nelson, who did the excellent The Domestics and the reimagining of
Wrong Turn.
There you go. Both very enjoyable. I love The Domestics. Thought that was absolutely superb. Rich, how do you get on with VHS 85?
Funnily enough, you know, I feel the opposite towards this film than I did with VHS 94.
94, yeah.
Was it 94 we did last time?
Mm-hmm.
Last time I there were a lot of the segments and that there were bits that I really enjoyed, and the wraparound story I felt was really weak, especially that, you know, the payoff at the end. Whereas I thought the wraparound story was the payoff that was really good, was probably the best thing in this. It ended on a high note, I thought. It worked out really well. Whereas the stories I was just found mostly a bit tiresome. But I do, you know, echo some of your sentiments in that the No Wake and Ambrosia thing was a great twist, not because I loved No Wake so much, but I it did end on a, oh, that's a weird sort of end point. And I like the fact that it kind of circled back, which is really unusual. I mean, usually if there's a through line, or the things weave in and out, it's more consistent. Whereas this is like everything is completely separate except for these two stories, which are made by the same director. So I thought that was really novel. But what I would say is, No Wake and Ambrosia are actually edited together as a half hour short on the extras of the DVD.
Oh, okay.
So I would probably, and funnily enough, also Total Copy is an unedited. There's an added, all the pieces together as one thing.
Yeah.
Also on there. So both those elements, you can watch divorced from the rest of the film, which I think would be better, because I think they're the two strongest parts. Although, you know, the sudden, the edited together, No Wake, kind of putting those two together, the sudden change will be quite more noticeable. But big movies have done the same thing of you run it in one way, and then all of a sudden what's the film, Barbarian recently, last year or whatever, it runs the story one way, then it runs, and then it goes and runs the story another way, and then it kind of, so it's the same idea. And I did like all the family get together and, oh, we've got this tradition kind of thing. And I was like, I think I can see where this is going to go. and there were little things like they've got these tattoos, but you could sort of just briefly see it in one of the shots early in the film, early in that segment. And it was like almost a subliminal thing that then comes in later, which I liked. Yeah. That was a little detail. So I thought that all worked out, and the payoff as well. I thought the whole payoff to like, how did that happen? Kind of, okay. Yeah. So I thought that worked really well. So yeah, Mike Nelson did a good job with those two. Better the second part, Ambrosia was the better of those two bits. Total Copy, in that Unsolved Mysteries kind of style, and the turning into a big kind of creature attack kind of sequence at the end was really good. So yeah, I didn't really have much time. I was really disappointed, because I was really looking forward to it, and I thought, you know, it starts out with the monster truck footage and things, and I thought they were getting the feel and the Total Copy kind of stuff gives you a good feel for the era, and then it just kind of didn't feel like it was it was, you know, it flirts with some conventions, stuff like the say No Wake is kind of flirting with a little bit of the slasher movie Friday the 13th kind of thing before going in a different direction. But apart from that, so yeah, I would say if you do get it on DVD, watch the bonus edits of those two three stories, rather than the whole thing. The Scott Derrickson one, I was quite really looking forward to seeing what he had, but I mean, I know Steve really liked it, but I couldn't click with that one. No. I was struggling to click with the whole film, basically. That's but yeah, so
I really liked the Dreamkill one up until the point where the detective proves to be the stupidest person on the police force. You know, he figures out who the killer is and then goes alone with him to confront him. It's like, what? You know, it's the dumbest thing ever. But the rest of it I thought worked really well. The action sort of stuff at the end, you know, that's where you know there's a sort of a name there, sort of, you know, playing with stuff. I liked the God of Death one. For the most part, it did sort of go on a bit too long, took a while, you know, too long to sort of get to where it needs to be.
I thought that one was the one that felt best of, like, it feels quite authentic and, you know, it's like it's cheap, Spanish TV new broadcast kind of thing. Yeah. I thought that worked well, but I lost interest after like 2 or 3 minutes once it was, and it was just like, I was like, when are we going to get to the fireworks factory kind of thing? I was like, what's
you get there eventually, you know? But it is a long
walk. You do.
It's a long walk, as they say. So the special effects in No Wake, especially, I thought they were superb. You know, there's one poor girl gets shot through the jaw. You know, it's pretty nasty. So all of that whole sequence, I thought they filmed it really well, you know, because it's all in camera, or it looks in camera effects, you know, because of the period and everything. Thought that worked really well. I think the what do you call it, total copy sequence would work better as a full film, as an unedited thing, because then I think it would congeal better. But I think the No Wake and Ambrosia bits actually works better separated.
I agree with you in that you get a more sense of satisfaction of the coming back to it after the story in the middle. I think that is lost
because there's a bit where the girl, sort of the main girl in it, gets sprayed with water by her nephew or whatever. And said, "Oh, the lady in the Winnebago gave me the water pistol," and then and it's at that point you go, "Ooh," but you're thinking, but in that case, why do they come after? You know, why? What is her relation to what's going on? So I think it worked better having that gap, you know, so your synapses start picking up on stuff, you know, rather than just being right. Okay, it is a following on. But anyway, I think this is an improvement over the last one. I mean, I did like a lot of the last one, but I enjoyed this one a lot more. Apart from, unfortunately, a lot of Techno God was not as good. Yeah. But roll on the next one. I know there's more of these coming at some point. You know, I think it's a decent format, really. You know, there's enough to play around with. But so scores on the doors. Steve?
Give me a 6.
Mm-hmm. I'm going for a 7. And Rich?
I'm going to go 5.
Mm-hmm. All right, then. A 5, a 6, and a 7 for VHS 85. Go check it out. Our short shot this week is The Spirit Hunters. An Interpol agent is sent to deal with a demon trying to open a portal to hell. But what is she to do with a petty criminal she's just arrested? This is another short that we saw last year, Rich, at the Fighting Spirit Film Festival. I do remember this one picking up a few awards as well. And rightly so. This has got some great visuals to it. Nice little fight sequence. And there's a sort of interesting sort of cross between, it's set in Finland, but our main character is Japanese.
Yes.
And she speaks Japanese, yet everyone can understand her, including the petty criminal who's definitely Finnish. But it works, it all works really well. I thoroughly enjoyed this one. And Steve, what do you make of the Spirit Hunters?
Yeah, I enjoy this one. It kind of reminded me of something a bit like a Resident Evil type thing, but with a bit of humor involved. It's one of them, it's a bit of an action shot, but like I said, it was the humor that got me with the criminal, the criminal.
I think
Because
he's just referred to as the petty criminal, isn't he? Not given any more.
She's the badass, she's the one who's going to be stopping it, and he's just fighting the minions, basically, that kind of thing. But the choreography was good, the effects were good, pacing was just straight through, all that, and yeah, I enjoyed it. It was good.
Awesome. Rich, what could you tell us about this one? As I said, we did catch it last year.
It's a new short from Mikko Leponen. Probably not pronouncing his name very well, but he is one of my favorite filmmakers working in the short films format. He does like visual effects and editing and stuff, but he's also, very good with many other filmmaking aspects. And say, I think as a director, he does some of the best stuff. Really ambitious, always mixing in some action and stuff. And this one's got a really interesting, dynamic with Kaori Kawaguchi as the in the lead. That brings, it starts out in Japanese, and that's going to sort of gives it a really interesting feel. And then it's kind of action horror, but then there's these little bits of comedy that they kind of pepper into it. So like she's on the phone and it's going, and it's like it's that I don't know, that old cartoon thing of the voice on the other end of the line is like high-pitched voice kind of thing, and really, really fast. And it that, that got laughs in the screenings, in screen that we saw. And it's just as funny now, but it's a bit random. And then there's some other jokes that are a bit random, because it's mostly quite straight, really. The feel is kind of Asian action movie, kind of got the. I mean, there was the short film also we saw at Fighting Spirit, but the previous year I think it was Duty Out of Line,
Oh
which was
yeah,
more
that
standard
was,
kind of
yeah,
Hong
sort of
Kong.
like almost like a Michelle Yeoh, Cynthia Khan kind of
Yeah,
thing. Yeah.
which I think would work fit really well in a double bill with this, because they're both quite different, but they're both pulling from the same kind of sources. The music, it's got that same particular feel. So I thought that this is great. I think it works really good. 8 minutes, it packs a lot in, does a little bit of world building, tries to mix different genres, interesting sort of casting choices, bit of visual effects and stuff. Miko's working with some of his regular collaborators, Esa Jussila as the cinematographer, and Jesse Liscola, who is an actor who works with and here plays the darkness demon. But Kaori Kawaguchi, oops, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that the names right, I apologize, but she's also done a short called Lady Samurai,
All right.
From a few years ago. That's well worth checking out. I would say definitely check out the rest of Miko's films that he's what he has done. So he's done absolutely tons, all a lot of them, working in sort of science fiction, and visual effects, and so one of the I'd really like to see him get a budget and be able to make a feature. I think he's worked on he's worked on films like Rendell, but not more supporting, sort of background, stuff, rather than getting a chance to sort of take the reins fully on a project. So Yeah, go check it out. One of the best, one of my favorites.
Mm. Yeah, we do recommend you check this out, but we don't score them. You will find a link to this in the footnotes below. Go check it out. Go check out some of the other films you'll find there. Our DTV throwback this week is Wedlock. In the not-too-distant future, jewel thief Frank Warren is double-crossed by his partner and thrown into a high-tech prison where inmates wear explosive collars which will explode if they stray too far from their unknown collar partner. When Frank is told who his collar partner is, the pair manage to escape, but can Frank trust her to survive long enough to deactivate his collar and find his jewels stash? So, a classic from the 90s. Rutger Hauer, Mimi Rogers, Joan Chen.
James Remar.
James Remar, yeah. Dodgy. Yeah, dodgy politics, all sorts going on here. Yeah, this works really well. I mean, obviously, you know, we had The Running Man as well, which had a similar idea with the collars. I can't remember if that came before or after this one, but
Running Man was before. That was in the 80s.
Yeah, so this was a made-for-TV movie, from what I understand. But it works really well. I remember it coming out on VHS. It came out around about the same time as Time Bomb, I believe, the Michael Bayne film. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's interesting because we get the whole prison movie bit, and then we get the sort of, you know, running on the lam, and the whole, you know, sort of coming up with contrivances to, you know, threaten to separate them while they still got the collars on and things like this. You know, very interesting. I think my favorite sequence is where you know, the police grab, I can't remember her name, Mimi Rogers' character, and drag her into the lift and leave him on the top floor. He's like, shit, got to get down. Yeah, that was really, really good. I think there's another bit where one of them's on a bus and the other isn't. That's to sort of try and catch up. Yeah, lots of little things like that. The prison stuff I thought was pretty good as well. Yeah, especially when he gets into that fight. Because you know, not only does the guy he's fighting, his thing blows up, but then you find out who his collar partner is, because he blows up too. All that sort of good stuff. Steve, you suggested this one. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I remember watching it years ago when it first came out. I mean, so we're talking 91, so it would have been like 10. So it's still been a long, long while. Because it was everywhere, everywhere. When every video you put on, the trailer was on there and stuff like that. But I kind of remember it being more prison based from years ago. I was actually quite surprised how much they're on the run and on the lam. But I thoroughly enjoyed it, to be fair. I thought Rutger was very understated in this. He's a very cool, calm and collected character. John Chen was actually quite annoying, to be fair. Her character is just a bit OTT. But yeah, it holds up. I thought it was actually really, really well done. Especially the, you know, like the exploding head effects, I thought they were done really well.
Yep.
Just the idea. I still think it's a great idea.
There are some sort of like, there are a couple of sort of weird bits. Like, do they have this thing like that? Oh, you get like a happy hour or something. All the men and women can mingle and all this. It's like, okay. And instead of, you know, solitary confinement is like a sensory deprivation tank.
Yeah.
Very 90s. But there's that bit that somebody, you know, because, you know, Rutger Hauer's character gets thrown in there, then somebody opens it up and pisses on him. It's really bad.
Well, again, that's the thing, you know, how many films do you see it where the warden's trying to get the loot off him or get some part of the loot. You know, we've seen it so many recently.
Yeah, it's a trope, isn't it?
You know, it does kind of work to get James Remar and George Chen back into the film in the latter half, obviously trying to get the money and the diamonds or whatever. I just thought it still holds up. It's still fun and still a good film, you know, because it's not one of them that tries to stray too far into the future. It's just, you know, when it came out, it's like, oh, in the distant future. And the only real difference is the collars.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. You
know, no flying cars or out like that. It's just, yeah, we've got these new collars that'll...
Yeah, yeah. All the cars and every, you know, all the vehicles you see in the film are like contemporary, aren't they? It's all
yeah.
Anyway. They do have barcode license plates, though.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't notice that. Anyway, Rich, how do you get on with Wedlock? I mean, I'm sure you've seen this before.
No, I hadn't actually. It's kind of one of those films I was always aware of.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Steve was saying, you know, it's kind of quite ubiquitous of you know the. You know, the promotion for it was kind of everywhere. The poster is very memorable, you know, the cover, because obviously, I mean, say it was made for HBO, but over here, you know, it was a video release and had quite a striking cover and stuff. And I would say, I don't know why I never kind of got around to seeing it, but it's always struck me that it looks very similar to Fortress, the Christopher Lambert film, which this actually predates by a good 2 or 3 years, I think. And there were some similarities, but as I think Steve said, you know, I was expecting more of it to be in the prison, and really the prison is kind of the setup, and then it turns into the prisoners on the run kind of defined
with the MacGuffin of the collars, chain. You know, so we've got to stay together, otherwise we're going to die. Yeah.
Instead of the handcuffs and stuff. So, yeah, I don't mind that. That's fine. Mm. But also, I was struck by how low budget it was.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a lot of money in this film. Compared to, say, Fortress, which I know was a theatrical film, but it did feel like it reminded me of like Rutger Hauer's sort of heyday was really already behind him by this point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like he was, you know, up until the late 80s, you know, he was going great guns, you know, headlining some, you know, even quite now, very fondly remembered films like, you know, Blind Fury and Wanted Dead or Alive and stuff like that. But, you know, now he's in the very much the sort of TV, DTV kind of part of his career. And, he's kind of not, you know, he is an anti-hero because he is a criminal. He's actually not, they kind of say, oh, you know, he kind of got dragged into it. But really, he's kind of got this slicked hair and stuff. He looks a bit slimy and you don't really like him very much. But, then he's kind of like you say, he's double crossed and stuff. And James Remar is really good in it as the friend, you know, the partner who double crosses him, and he comes back later in the movie and stuff. He's really good. There are some really good people in the cast. Stephen Tobolowsky is the warden, and he's quite, well, I'd say, playing against type, but sometimes he does play to that type. He's one of those kind of actors. He's often described as like nebbish, you know, the characters that he plays. Mm. But here he's very confident here, and he's not nice. There's very much a kind of a, like you say, you've referenced the, you know, the tropes and stuff. You know, the Shawshank Redemption used it as well. So that kind of came to mind as different kind of thing. But Danny Trejo appears, has like one or two lines. That was and a nice death scene, which I liked. Basil Wallace is in there from Marked for Death, unrecognizable compared to his role in Marked for Death, but he's there. The whole sort of cheap production design of it was, like you say, that sensory deprivation tank scene. There's literally nothing really there, and they just bung him in the sensory deprivation. And I was wondering, how long was he in there? He grew a beard. So he must have been in there, like, how long does it take to grow a beard? Like four weeks?
At least, yeah.
Yeah, for me, so to get something like that. Anyway, Joan Chen here. He and she and Rutger Hauer had also done Salute of the Jugger, which I also haven't seen.
I haven't seen that one. I was just thinking. I was going to ask you guys, what would you say your biggest hole in sort of his filmography is for you?
Yeah, I don't know. Around this time, he also did Split Second, which I did see.
Yeah,
I was very much on
cinema.
Top of that one. But
yeah,
and a few years later, Surviving the Game, which is probably his high point, I think, for the 90s,
like
in terms of the films that he did. Yeah, a lot of it. I mean, he was very much going into proper DTV by the mid to late 90s.
Well, there's two for me. One is Salute of the Jugger, as you say, and the other is a film he did called A Breed Apart.
Oh, that's one he did in the, was that early 80s, mid 80s?
84.
84. Yeah, I haven't seen that one either.
Yeah,
I actually haven't seen a lot of his older stuff. I've not seen him in the Osterman Weekend or Lady.
Oh,
Wolf,
that's good. I like Osterman Weekend.
Even Wanted Dead or Alive, I hadn't seen until a few years ago.
Oh,
so
I remember that when I was a kid. Yeah,
but I do. I've always really liked Rutger Hauer. Actually, Hobo with a Shotgun. I've been wanting to watch that for years, and I do want to check that out at some point soon. So he's. I get what you guys were saying. You know, Hauer is quite understated in this one. He's kind of there's a whole section of the film where he's wearing this really colourful jacket, predating Steven Seagal's fashion choices in On Deadly Ground and Fire Down Below and stuff. It's like it's a total Seagal look. I mean, I was like, wow, wonder where that came from. But that's if he's trying not to stand out, they picked the wrong clothes. But the other thing is Mimi Rogers kind of puts me off, because I always associate Mimi Rogers with like TV movie, lifetime-ish sort of TV movies rather than anything action-y and stuff. Yeah. And, you know, you go back and see this, it's like really random, and she's good, she's fine, you know, she's great, but it's, you just think, oh yeah, you know, she became like, you know, familiar with these other kind of more roles, you know, the sort of TV thrillers and things like that. She was doing, you know, actiony roles and stuff. It's like, it seems quite random. And it reminds me, I need to give her more credit and maybe check out a few more of her films, because I've always kind of steered around Mimi Rogers. I thought she was all right. What was the other one? What was the other thing I was going to mention? There's a great bus chase scene kind of thing, which is pretty cool. Which, funnily enough, it wasn't buses, but you have some big vehicles in, or at least one or two big vehicles in Fortress. So, again, I do wonder if somebody watched Fortress, or watched this before they made Fortress. I do think Fortress is mostly set in the prison. I think it's a lot better film, had a bigger budget and stuff. But I do wonder if there's a little bit of an influence between these two. What was I going to say? The whole thing with James Remar and Stephen Tobolowsky's character and stuff, that very much reminded me of RoboCop. You know, the way that Clarence Boddicker, Kurtwood Smith's character, is in cahoots with the head of OCP and stuff. So I thought there was a little, maybe there was an influence that came from there. And Scanners, maybe, with the exploding collar. I mean, the head effects look very similar to like Scanners. Rutger Hauer's kind of being a bit quirky in this, as he sometimes is. He's one of those kind of guys. I think you get some value from him. He's kind of plopped into this sort of sci-fi action thing that he's kind of going with it, and it's but you it's not his, you know, he's more of a, you know, he's a quirky Dutch actor, and he always likes to bring a little something. So I think that makes it quite novel. But yeah. Final thought is it's directed by Lewis Teague, who's got a really interesting filmography, but I think his hits were kind of behind him by this point. Yeah. I think The Jewel of the Nile was probably the biggest film that he made, but I know that wasn't a massive hit. But the film of his that I remember mostly was Alligator. But he also did things like Kujai, Cat's Eye, and Navy SEALs, which was like the year before this, I think, or around the same time he did Navy SEALs, which I did see at the time. But
Got a soft spot for that one.
What, Navy SEALs?
Yeah,
I should give it another shot one day. I didn't really love it much at the time. He also did Collision Course, the Jay Leno and Pat Morita movie.
Oh yeah,
which possibly contributed to the end of his run as a as a theatrical filmmaker, but still had a very has had a very solid career after this. But it's like very much the a bit like Rutger Hauer himself. You know, his hits were in the '80s. That's where he, you know, indeed. That's where he sort of came from. But yeah, interesting choice. Glad that Steve picked it. I had been wanting to check it out for a while, so
absolutely,
really, really good to have a chance to see it.
Awesome. We don't score the shorts. We don't score the throwbacks, but we do recommend you check them out. We found this one on YouTube, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah, it's hard to find it any, you know, on any streaming services or anything. But yeah, there's a couple of copies floating around on the old YouTube.
Yeah, and we'll put a link to one of them in the footnotes. That is the end of this week's show. So thank you for listening. Don't forget to check us out on Facebook and Twitter at the DTV Digest, and also the Short Shots, where we've got a nice library of shorts that we've curated and put together, covering action, horror, thrillers, sci-fi, fan movies, all sorts.
Almost a thousand.
Exactly. Good grief. You could just sort of watch three or four during your lunch break and you'd be thoroughly entertained. On that note, thank you for listening. Tune in next time.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.